Chapter 22. Harry put out a hand to take it, and Stoker intervened, neatly plucking it out of reach.
I think I will take custody of that,
Stoker said, in a tone that dared him to oppose. Harry's smile was ingratiating.
Of course. I presume these were your associates bent upon the diamond's recovery, Stoker said to him.
Harry shrugged.
If it was a giant Nordic fellow, then I suppose so. But how they found me, or knew the diamond was in the orrery, is unfathomable. You might have told them,
Stoker pointed out. Harry sighed.
But I didn't know. I will be perfectly honest with you. Had I known, I wouldn't be here now. I would have taken the bloody thing, given it to Isabel, and got on with my life. That diamond is the price on my head, if you will remember.
I looked at Stoker. As much as I hate to agree with Harry, it does make precious little sense for him to have arranged a confederate to break in and steal the diamond if he knew where it was. It would be a simple enough matter for him to take it himself.
Thank you,
Harry said, attempting to look appreciative. Do not place your gratitude in me. It is misguided, I informed him. I grant you common sense, but nothing more. Besides, the intruder was not your Nordic fellow. Does this Isabel creature have no other associates?
None that I know, Harry said. She might have hired one,
Stoker pointed out. And thereby risk being double-crossed again when Harry has already cost her a fortune? I do not think so, I said slowly. I understand the female mind better than either of you. I suspect her methods will be completely personal, just herself and her most trusted companion, this pet Swede of hers.
Joran,
Harry reminded me darkly.
His name is Joran. As it ought to be,
Stoker replied.
A good Scandinavian name.
I have always preferred Odin, Harry said idly.
For a dog, perhaps, but it lacks a certain dignity for a human,
Stoker replied. I cleared my throat. If we might return to the matter at hand. I saw the fellow. He was most definitely not a Scandinavian. In fact, his was a most decidedly Indian face, and a good-looking one at that.
Indian?
Stoker's gaze sharpened, and I knew what he was thinking. Anjali, I said in agreement. Harry looked from me to Stoker and back again.
What has just happened?
Stoker and I had a conversation, I told him.
But you did not say anything.
We did not have to. A gentleman of Indian origin has this night attempted to steal the diamond, also of Indian origin, from its place of concealment. And one person with access to it at Hathaway Hall was the third factor of Indian origin.
Anjali,
Stoker finished.
She has access both to Lady Hathaway's room, whence the jewel was taken, and to Effie's observatory. She might easily have taken the diamond from her ladyship's room and secured it into the orrery, thereby ensuring it would reach London and not be discovered, should Charles insist upon a search of the hall,
Stoker added.
Then who is the fellow who broke in here?
Harry demanded. A confederate, I deduced. It would be a very easy thing to send a quick cable to a fellow conspirator waiting here in London to receive the diamond, giving him its location.
Terribly risky,
Harry said.
Audacious,
Stoker agreed.
They could not be certain we would not inspect the orrery immediately.
But it was unlikely we would, I said. We had travelled up from Devon and arrived rather late. What more natural than that we should put it aside in favour of your thylacine and the post that had arrived in our absence, which, I shall remind you, is precisely what we did. And an attempt has been made to recover the orrery the very first night we have returned to London. To wait longer would be a far greater risk. This was audacious, but not reckless. A calculated gamble. A throw of the dice by a desperate young woman.
Unjolly?
Harry asked. Effie, I corrected.
Effie!
Harry looked affronted. A most unhappy soul, I said. Continually belittled, made to feel small. Her accomplishments and talents given little value in that house. She is, to them, a pair of hands and a strong back, no better than a pack animal. If the Hathaways have their way, she will be nothing more than livestock to them, domesticated out of every impulse towards genius.
She does seem to resent being pulled away from her studies after her grandfather's death,
Harry put in.
Poor girl.
Quite, I said briskly. Harry cocked his head.
What exactly do you mean to do with that?
He inquired, his avid gaze resting on the jewel still clutched in Stoker's hand.
I shall keep it safe until we have determined what must be done with it,
Stoker said.
It is late, and there is too much at stake to make rash decisions. We should all go back to bed and salvage what we may of the night's rest. Tomorrow we will discuss it. A council of war?
Harry said in a light voice. But his smile was tight, and I suspected he resented Stoker's taking charge of the situation. Exactly that. Stoker's suggestion has merit, and to ensure that we all cooperate, I will go with you, Harry, I said, pushing him towards the staircase. Over his feeble protests, I stayed hard upon his heels along with the dogs, all of us herding him back to bed. For some minutes we heard various clangings and bangings from the floor below, where Stoker was clearly attempting to mislead us as to where he concealed the jewel. I heard the ring of metal, a suit of armour, the bright shudder of a glass pane closed too quickly, a tall clock rescued from a chateau during the Revolution, the soft splash of the aquarium, where a pair of fat, lazy goldfish spent their days swimming over assorted pebbles. He shoved the drawers of an apothecary chest from the Italian Renaissance, slammed the door of a Spanish cardinal's prie-dieu, and even clattered a few of the Sicilian marionettes that Lord Rosmorin had recently acquired. For the better part of a quarter of an hour, he rampaged about the place, laying false trails, until at last his dark head appeared at the winding stair leading to the snuggery. "Have you quite finished?" I asked pleasantly. "Only it seems one or two of the walls are still standing."
"I was merely ensuring a good hiding place,"
he replied.
"No offence was intended by my thoroughness." "None taken,"
Harry assured him. He had stretched out on his mattress, Newt tucked at his side, both of his hands laced behind his head.
"Although one might wonder if your precautions were not a trifle over-enthusiastic."
"You ought to be thanking him," I retorted. "If our intruder were to return and secure the diamond, he would be signing your death warrant. I presume Mrs. MacGregor would not be best pleased if the thing were nipped out from under her nose." Harry shuddered.
"She would not."
"Then let us rest," I suggested, snapping my fingers at Vespertine to come and lie beside me. "There are only a few hours left until daybreak, and who knows what fresh intrigue tomorrow will bring." Within minutes, the pair of them were snoring again, the dogs joining in the chorus. Beside me, Vespertine's breathing was deep and slow, and I rested one hand upon her deep chest. But sleep did not come so easily for me. As I lay, staring into the darkness, I continued to revisit the events of the night. My glimpse of the intruder had been brief, but I could not shake the feeling that I had seen him somewhere before. I must have slept at some point, and heavily, for when I awoke I was entirely alone in the snuggery. I washed in the tiny water closet that had been plumbed for our convenience, and brushed the creases from the clothes in which I had slept. In spite of the fitful night, I felt a surge of energy. Adventure beckoned, and although I deplored spending any more time than necessary with Harry, I could only appreciate the situation in which we now found ourselves. A priceless diamond, a thief in the night, a man returned from the dead, a mortal enemy determined to ensure his destruction. It was all thoroughly satisfactory, I reflected. I descended to find Harry tucking into his breakfast with gusto, while Stoker was already at work upon his thylacine. "Your single-mindedness is astonishing," I told him, as he grinned over the back of the beast at me. His shirt was already begrimed with sawdust and glue, and any number of other substances I could not hope to identify. "How is it?" He shrugged.
"Salvageable. The hide is in excellent condition, although the original taxidermist's grasp of the anatomy is rudimentary in the extreme. See here."
He launched into an explanation of the intricacies of Thylacinus cynocephalus with vigour, until I held up a quelling hand. "I beg you, not before breakfast."
"Oh, there is a way to stop him?"
Harry asked, looking distinctly bedevilled.
"I had a 20-minute lecture on the mandibular structure."
"Only 20? Count yourself fortunate," I advised. "Stoker can speak at length and extempore on any number of subjects, so long as he has access to proper hydration and copious amounts of sugar. The longest I have personally witnessed was 6.5 hours on a walrus, but that was a special occasion."
"That particular occasion is the reason that Lady Torrington pledged £1,000 to build her own wing of the Rosmoren Museum," Stoker said mildly.
"Indeed, and your thylacine is very nice," I soothed. "Harry does not appreciate it because he is a Philistine. Perhaps you ought to mount him and add him to the collection." Harry eyed me narrowly over the breakfast dishes.
"You are in a distinctly jolly mood this morning."
"Nonsense," I said, pouring out a cup of tea. I sniffed the steam appreciatively. "I am never jolly."
"You are in higher spirits than when you retired,"
he amended. "That I am," I agreed. I forked up a healthy bite of egg and savoured it. I had, upon waking, and in that curious state betwixt dreaming and consciousness, finally placed where I had seen the intruder's face before. I was on the point of sharing the information when the dogs began to prick up their ears. "Someone is coming," I said. Harry groaned.
"I already had to hide behind a packing case when the boy brought breakfast down."
"George is a good lad with too much work to poke about. The Beauclerc children have far worse manners," I said, whisking aside the breakfast dishes. "There is no time to climb up to the snuggery. Into the sarcophagus," I ordered. Muttering all the while, Harry climbed in, and Stoker had just settled the lid into place when there was a scratch at the door, and it opened.
"Hello,"
called a familiar voice. "Sir Hugo," I said faintly, "whatever brings you to the Belvedere?" He entered, hat in hand, and smelling of fresh aftershave.
"I am on my way to Scotland Yard and thought I would stop in,"
he said.
"Marlebon is not on the way from your house to Scotland Yard,"
Stoker pointed out.
I was not at my house,
Sir Hugo returned.
I was in St. John's Wood, clearing up a matter for the Home Secretary, but you did not hear that from me,
he added. I flicked a glance at Stoker. St. John's Wood was where the great and good stashed their ladies of light virtue. Whatever the Home Secretary had been getting up to in that particular suburb, it was a rather good wager that Mrs. Home Secretary did not know about it. Sir Hugo settled himself into Stoker's desk chair, the only other option being the camel saddle, and crossed one long leg over the other. His expression was expansive. He was clearly pleased with the results of his own night's work. I am sorry to say there has been a development, I began. He waved a hand.
The diamond, the elusive and legendary Eye of the Dawn. Yes, I know. Effie wrote. That is how I knew you'd come back. She mentioned that a pair of natural historians had been to stay. She quite enjoyed meeting you, you know. But then this business of the jewel going missing set the cat amongst the pigeons, and that was the end of your visit.
Did she tell you anything else? I asked. I was conscious of Stoker, continuing to work quietly on his thylacine as Sir Hugo and I talked. Sir Hugo shrugged.
That my instincts were correct. This Jonathan was an impostor, and helped himself to Lady Hathaway's diamond before fleeing. Naturally, we are making inquiries. We know he crossed the moor and boarded the train to London at Batley, but the trail has gone cold at that point.
I could almost hear the sigh of relief from inside the sarcophagus. But you will continue to pursue the thief? I pressed.
Of course,
Sir Hugo said, his brows raising in obvious astonishment.
The fellow has stolen a diamond worth almost as much as the Koh-i-Noor.
I imagine that sort of crime would carry a heavy penalty, I mused.
Oh, to be certain. But of course we do not hang people for it these days. More's the pity.
A stifled noise came from the direction of the sarcophagus.
What's that?
Sir Hugo asked, looking around.
My apologies, Stoker called. I sneezed.
Ah, Gesundheit,
Sir Hugo said. He sighed.
To complicate matters, Lady Hathaway is being most obstructive. She refuses to cooperate, claiming she gave the stone to the fellow, although the rest of them maintain it was stolen. But without her cooperation, you cannot prosecute him, Stoker said from behind his thylacine. She is, after all, the owner.
Or is she? I pondered aloud. Sir Hugo blinked.
Whatever do you mean?
Only that Lady Hathaway was oblique as to how her husband came to be in possession of the parure. She said he acquired it during the confusion of the Sepoy Mutiny.
Yes,
he prompted. Acquired is not the same thing as purchased, I reminded him. Things were chaotic during the mutiny, and many Englishmen proved they were not above a little light looting. If Sir Geoffrey stole the jewels...
Stole?
Sir Hugo looked thunderous.
Now see here, Geoffrey Hathaway was a fine man, stalwart and loyal to Queen and country.
Yes, I said patiently. His queen, his country, not India. He wouldn't have been the first Englishman to help himself to something that didn't belong to him.
Yes, well,
Sir Hugo said, grumbling as he sat back in his chair.
I hope you are not implying that it is within one's rights to steal something from a person who has in turn stolen it. If so, you are sailing in muddy waters, Miss Speedwell. A veritable ethical swamp, if you will.
I bared my teeth in an attempt at a smile. I was just thinking aloud.
Well, perhaps you ought not to think if it leads you to such places,
he said, with a touch of his old pomposity.
In any event, I wanted to thank you for bestirring yourself to help in this private matter. Naturally, your efforts will not be reflected in the formal records of Special Branch, as this was not an official assignment, but you have my personal gratitude, and you may rely upon me to remember it.
He rose to leave, and I stopped him. What of Euphemia? I asked. His expression was blank.
What of her?
I stifled my exasperation. When you first spoke of her, you remarked upon her dissatisfaction. I cannot see that it will be in any way improved in the future, governed as she is by her brother and his wife. She ought to be educated for her vocation of astronomy. Sir Hugo shrugged.
I am afraid it is out of my hands. Charles wishes her to remain at home, and it would be inappropriate of me to interfere.
I faced him, my hands curling into fists at my sides. She is your goddaughter. You have an obligation to her. His brows rose nearly to his hairline.
To her spiritual development, and she is a confirmed member of the Church of England. Beyond that, it would be the grossest intrusion upon Charles's authority within his own family for me to speak upon this matter.
She is unhappy with her place, I began.
She is a woman,
Sir Hugo said simply,
and she has no money. It is up to her brother to look after her, and it is her lot to make herself happy within that.
You cannot seriously believe that she deserves less happiness than anyone else simply because she is a woman, I said, my temper rising.
My dear Miss Speedwell, I am merely pointing out that all of us must be useful if we cannot be independent. Now, I have every intention of settling a small annuity on Effie upon the occasion of my death. One hopes that by the time of that event, which I trust will be some years in the future, he said with a touch of acerbity, she will have acquired the necessary discipline and self-control to conduct herself appropriately and manage her independence. Until then, it will be instructive for her to learn to master her wilder impulses.
You speak of her as though she wanted to run away and join the circus, I retorted. Sir Hugo, I can assure you Effie does not want to tame tigers. She wants only to work, to establish herself as a scientist in her own right after a suitable course of study.
And, as I have said, it is not my place to interfere in her family's arrangements for her,
he said dryly.
We must, after all, accept that they know best.
Must we? I should like to point out that a few days ago you seemed concerned about her tendency towards melancholy. You danced to a different tune today, and I am left to wonder why. He flapped an impatient hand.
I have had a letter from Charles. He discovered that Effie has been writing to me and wanted to give me his personal assurances that she is improving.
His assurances? Charles Hathaway is more concerned with his sheep than his sister, I can promise you. He is the very last person to understand a personality like Effie's. Sir Hugo stroked his moustaches, his expression indulgent.
And you think that after the acquaintance of, what was it, a day? Two, at most? That you are better placed than her own brother to comprehend Effie?
Her own dog is better placed, I retorted. And yes, it wanted only a very short acquaintance to make it perfectly apparent that she is a highly strung and thoroughly frustrated young woman who needs her talents to be appreciated and directed.
And they will be,
he countered smoothly.
Mary Hathaway will supervise her and ensure she is not idle. Charles thinks they have been too indulgent with her, allowing her to spend her days in fanciful pursuits, and that this has led to her melancholia.
It is not melancholia, it is grief. She has lost the only person in the world who seemed to understand her, her grandfather. and no one else bestirs themselves to know her. It is a wonder she has not drowned herself in a bog.
She would not dare,
Sir Hugo countered roundly.
The Hathaways are an eccentric family, but they have never been given to hysteria.
She is not hysterical, I said through gritted teeth. She is unhappy because she is treated like a child or a drudge when she wants only a little kindness and respect. She needs intelligent conversation like a plant needs the sun, and she will not find it in that house.
Sir Hugo threw up his hands.
I find we are at an impasse, Miss Speedwell. I can only thank you for your time and say that I hope you did not find the task too arduous.
He rose and shot his cuffs.
Good day to you, Stoker,
he called with a nod. He let himself out, and Stoker went to liberate Harry from his sarcophagus. Harry emerged with a wheeze.
Is it dusty inside?
Stoker inquired.
No, no,
Harry said, his expression bland.
I quite like the dirt. It adds a certain piquant charm. In fact, I am growing rather fond of the place. I am thinking of moving in permanently, perhaps putting up a few shelves and installing a stove.
Ass, I said distinctly. I turned to my correspondents and began to open envelopes with a silver fruit knife, slicing with a certain satisfying savagery.
Whatever did those letters do to deserve such brutality?
Harry asked, plucking an apple from Stoker's desk. He polished it upon his lapel and took a healthy bite.
Better the letters than your hide, I warned. Or yours, I added, with a glare at Stoker. You were suspiciously quiet during Sir Hugo's visit. You might have spoke in favour of Euphemia Hathaway's liberation.
To what end?
He inquired with a shrug.
Sir Hugo will do as he pleases. He is not to be shifted from his position.
I do not remember his being so pompous, I said.
He received a fair bollocking from the newspapers and Parliament over the Ripper affair,
Stoker reminded me.
I think it has disarranged his confidence. He was comfortable taking risks, entertaining new ideas, but his failure to catch the Ripper has left him vulnerable. J.J. Butterworth alone has written 5 pieces calling for his resignation over the past few months,
he added, invoking the name of our sometime adversary, sometime friend. J.J. was an intrepid and engaging reporter, but she could also be the very devil if she were hot upon the heels of a story. She was the most ambitious creature I had ever met, and I was not surprised she had taken steady aim at the head of Special Branch. Harry had been listening raptly as he ate his apple, his head swivelling from Stoker to me and back again. He swallowed, then looked at us brightly.
I say, does anyone want to explain why you were such close chums with the head of Special Branch? That was Sir Hugo Montgomery, was it not?
It was, and no, we do not, I replied.
Then perhaps we could discuss my diamond, its current whereabouts and when I can have it back,
he suggested.
It is not yours, and no, you may not,
Stoker said calmly.
You were the one who said we would have a council of war,
Harry protested.
I have changed my mind.
That is hardly sporting,
Harry began. I leapt to my feet.
Newspapers, I exclaimed.
I scrabbled around my desk for the newspaper I had been reading the day we returned to London.
Veronica, what are you on about?
Harry inquired.
I have just remembered where I saw the face of our intruder, I said, thumbing hastily through the pages with ink-stained fingers until I found it. Here, the Maharani of Viratanagar has arrived in London to participate in informal discussions with members of Parliament
It is rumoured the discussions will touch upon the growing support for Indian independence, I read aloud. Photographed with her grandson and heir, by Rav. I pointed to the photograph. In the centre was the Maharani, a statuesque woman of some years. She had a long, elegant nose, giving her a distinctive profile, and a head of thick, dark hair. She was dressed in traditional Indian fashion, an elaborate arrangement of draperies and veils heavily embroidered with jewels. More gems were in evidence on her arms and bosom, hanging from her ears and encircling her fingers. She was a woman accustomed to commanding attention and authority, and her expression was one of cool detachment. Next to her stood a slender young man dressed in narrow trousers with a long-fitted coat that buttoned quite up to the throat. He had her nose, as well as her sharp assessing eyes, and was even more youthful in his photograph than he had been in person. "They are staying at the Sudbury Hotel," I said. "We must lose no time." I reached for my hat as Stoker quirked up a brow.
"The word Maharani means High Queen. Do I understand that you mean to accuse the grandson of a High Queen of being a common burglar?"
"I do not mean to accuse anyone," I replied. "That would be grossly irresponsible."
"Then what is your plan exactly?" Harry asked.
"The first rule of any scientific endeavour is observation," I said, rummaging in the box of operatic costumes for a piece of veiling. I pinned it over my hat, obscuring my features. I did not think our young miscreant had got a very good look at my face, but it would not do to let him know we were on to him. "We will go to the Sudbury and simply observe, to confirm it is, in fact, the Maharani's grandson."
"We ought to speak with Julien," Stoker put in. "He is always a fount of information."
I smiled at the mention of the hotel's head pâtissier. "You mean gossip, but yes, he might well know something useful. But you cannot go like that. You are filthy, with at least 7 identifiable stains upon your shirt." Stoker grumbled, but went off to change, as I turned to Harry. "You are no tidier than Stoker. You have traces of mummy clinging to your clothes, and you are still in evening dress." He pulled a face.
"I have no other clothes, remember?"
I sighed, recalling his woeful tale of fleeing the hall with the clothes upon his back and a few measly shilling notes in his note-case. I went to my desk and unlocked the drawer which held my own purse, fishing out a handful of notes. "Take this. You cannot walk around London like that unless you mean to attract exactly the wrong sort of attention. Outfit yourself and meet us at the Sudbury." His fingers closed around the notes slowly, almost reluctantly, I fancied. He shoved them into his pocket, then scribbled a few lines on a piece of paper and signed it with a flourish. "What is this?" I asked.
"An IOU,"
he informed me. I felt a mocking response rise to my lips, but something in his gaze stilled my tongue. He seemed, to my astonishment, embarrassed at being made alone, and I realised his intention to repay me was serious. "How long do you require to make yourself presentable?" I asked politely. He shrugged.
2 hours? I will stop in and get a proper shave as well," he added,
rubbing a hand over his bewhiskered chin.
"I feel an absolute ape."
"The hotel has an exceptional barber," I advised. "They even managed to get Stoker's chin smooth, and that is an Herculean task. Go there after you have found suitable attire and let them finish you off."
"An excellent notion," he said.
We were like characters in a farce, I realised, saying very polite things to one another and studiously avoiding anything of substance. As if guessing my thoughts, He reached out a sudden hand, stopping just short of touching my sleeve.
Veronica, I wanted to thank you.
Before he could finish, Stoker appeared, adjusting a fresh collar as he tugged on his jacket.
Have I interrupted?
He asked, with a bland, mirthless smile. Not in the slightest, I assured him. I reminded Harry to slip out of the grounds of the Belvedere undetected when he left, and we decided upon a time for our rendezvous. Stoker made no comment upon the arrangements until we were in Marylebone High Street, hailing a hansom.
You realise we have left him alone with the diamond?
He remarked in a bland voice. He has 2 hours in which he must find a new suit of clothes, get to the Sudbury, and have himself barbered. Hardly time for him to make a proper search. Besides, I am entirely certain you have hid the thing well enough he would not find it in a fortnight, I answered.
Oh, I rather hope he does, Stoker said.
A tiny smile played over his lips, but he said no more, and I dared not ask. Chapter 23. We arrived at the Sudbury in the lull between breakfast and luncheon, the time when only the earliest of risers would be out and about. Those who moved in society's highest circles often went to bed just before daybreak, having spent the night in various entertainments and debaucheries. A morning ride in Rotten Row would not commence until sometime after noon, but I was made of sterner stuff. I had long ago got in the habit of rising with the sun, and I had little patience with those who dozed away the prettiest and most productive hours of the day. The hotel was just beginning to come to life when we settled ourselves in the lobby. Stoker had taken the precaution of making a purchase at the newsstand outside and opened his newspaper with a casual gesture. He passed me a ladies' fashion paper, at which I pulled a face, although I was interested and not a little pleased to see how thoroughly out of style the bustle had become. Bustles, while permitting an elegant drape of fabric from the front of the figure to the back, were a ridiculous invention. I had scant use for them, largely because they were so utterly pointless. I might have tolerated them better if one could carry things about, a selection of weaponry or a nice picnic lunch, for example. I was just about to make this observation to Stoker when I saw them. The lift doors, highly polished mahogany fitted with brass, opened, and the Maharani, dressed much as she had been in her photograph, emerged. Her grandson paced just behind her. He looked a little tired, and I noted with some satisfaction the cut high upon his cheek.
I see him,
Stoker murmured from behind his newspaper.
Was it necessary to hit the poor fellow?
I did not hit him, I protested around my fashion paper. He must have been cut by some of the flying glass when the orrery smashed.
And this is definitely our man?
Indeed so, I said. I peeped over the edge of my fashion paper to watch the Maharani and her grandson make their departure through the main doors. A carriage was waiting at the curb for them, drawing smartly away as soon as the doorman closed them in. If only all detectable work were so gratifying, I mused. That was 10 minutes gone, and already we have found our man.
The question is, what do we mean to do with him?
Stoker said softly. I nibbled at my lip. An excellent question. As you say, we can hardly accuse him directly of being the author of the crime. Or can we? I began.
No, we cannot,
Stoker said, with unaccustomed firmness. He folded his newspaper and rose.
I am going to see Julien and allow him to feed me. You may come or not, as you please.
I trotted after him, through the discreet door that led to the hotel's basement. It was a warren of various domestic offices, kitchens, laundries, pantries, and the pervasive London smell of damp stone was overlaid with more wholesome and appetizing aromas. We found Julien Dorland in his domain, the pastry kitchen, overseeing the arrangement of an elaborate confection.
"My friends,"
Julien exclaimed, coming to shake hands with Stoker. He eyed my veil and lifted it to kiss me on either cheek.
"One cannot hide such beauty, my dear Veronica,"
he murmured into my ear. I grinned. Julien's flirtations were as innocent as they were obvious. He would happily kiss hands and cheeks and drop compliments like bonbons, but he was surprisingly monogamous when his heart was engaged. He had recently become enthralled with a widow of comfortable means, and his erotic attentions were reserved solely for her. He brandished his pastry bag.
"I am very nearly finished here, but the Gâteau Saint-Honoré waits for no one,"
he said gravely, as he applied a series of piped embellishments of stiffly whipped cream around the edge of a circle of puff pastry. Pâte à choux had been piped atop this, and the entire thing was topped with profiteroles, held in place with sticky golden strands of sugar, transformed by the alchemy of heat and time into amber caramel.
"Beautiful,"
Stoker breathed.
"My friend, you cannot see the most luscious part. The inside is filled with crème chibouste,"
he teased, as Stoker made a whimpering sound in his throat. Julien handed him a bowl of leftover crème chibouste and a spoon.
"Come,"
he beckoned.
"We will go where we may be private."
"How do you know that is necessary?" I asked. He gave me a knowing look.
"With the two of you, it is always necessary."
Julien issued a series of rapid instructions to his crew and then shepherded us into his private room, a sort of study where he kept his cookery notebooks, bottles of exquisitely expensive syrups he concocted himself, and assorted mementos from his travels. A pretty religious statue had been added to the collection, a churchman clutching a baker's peel. "You have a new friend," I observed. Julien gave the saint a fond look.
"Saint Honoré, the patron of pastry chefs. You will note his mitre. He was bishop of Amiens in his day, and not to be confused with the patron of the boulanger, Saint Lazare. His feast day is in a few weeks, and I am making them always to practice his special cake,"
he added, nodding towards the pastry kitchen, where his assistants were still struggling to replicate the intricate Gâteau Saint-Honoré. He sat back in his chair, folding his hands expansively over his taut middle. For a pastry chef, Julien had a remarkably slender physique, fit and wiry in spite of the masses of sugar he consumed. He was dressed in a chef's coat of pristine white, but he never wore a toque, preferring instead a soft cap, usually of crimson velvet. Today's effort was new, still velvet, but a striking shade of cyclamen. "A gift from your lady friend," I guessed. He smiled, broadly enough to show his dimples.
"She makes me many gifts, ma petite chou."
"So you have entirely given up on the idea of wooing J.J. Butterworth?" I inquired. "It was only January when your head was quite turned by her charms." He shrugged.
"Dough cannot rise in the cold,"
he said cryptically.
"But you did not come to discuss my love life. How are you, my friends?"
"In need of information,"
Stoker said. But, having scraped the bowl of crème chibouste clean, He allowed his gaze to drift to a small plate of enticing, tiny glazed fruit tarts that shimmered like jewels. Julien, attentive as always, offered the plate to me first, then thrust it into Stoker's hands.
"You must try them. I am not unhappy," he said.
High praise from such an exacting practitioner of the pastry arts. My little tart had been filled with a bit of crème anglaise and then heaped with candied apricots and glazed, the whole affair topped with brandied sugar spun into a miniature bird's nest. I swallowed the last delectable crumb and sucked the sugar from my fingers. "You are truly a master," I said with a happy sigh. Julien waved aside the praise, but his pleasure was obvious.
"No, if I were to guess, you have come either to inquire about the opera singer, who is currently in residence with her husband and her lover, or the Maharani."
"Got it in one,"
Stoker told him through a mouthful of tart.
"Which?"
Julien asked. "The Maharani," I said promptly. Under other circumstances, I would have been thoroughly entertained by a little salacious operatic gossip. But a lady and two men with claims upon her attentions struck a bit too near the bone for my comfort. Julien tipped his head back and steepled his fingers.
"A very elegant lady, the Maharani. She favours silks in very strong colours, which suit her. Not everyone can wear orange,"
he advised me.
"With your complexion, you should not attempt it."
"I never would," I assured him. He went on.
"But on her, it is dramatic as a rising sun. A most enchanting effect. And her figure is very good. She is not so young, you understand, but with such excellent breasts."
"Yes, thank you,"
Stoker said, flushing a delicate shade of rose.
"Do you not wish to hear about her breasts?"
Julien asked.
"My friend, they are delectable. Not too large, just beautifully formed."
Once Julien began enumerating a woman's charms, he could go on for hours. "Something besides her breasts," I suggested. He shrugged.
"They are lovely, but not as matchless as her eyes. Englishmen,"
he said, with a moo of displeasure,
"do not always appreciate the subtleties of difference in the shades of brown. They see skin and hair and eyes which are dark and think, this is all the same. But no, God has wrought each with a poet's hand, giving tones and shades. One must look closely in order to see. Do you understand? And no one sees as well as Julien d'Orland,"
he added, puffing out his chest.
"The Maharani has eyes like polished gems, full of light and intelligence. She is accustomed to command. She does not drop her eyes modestly like an English woman, but she lifts her chin and dares one to look away. I find her enchanting, although she does not eat enough,"
he added with a frown.
"It is often the way with those raised in that part of Asia. They have not the habit of sugar, so their taste for sweets is fruit, always fruit. I tempt her with my delicacies, and always she sends the maid to say, 'My mistress will have a mango. A mango!'"
He rolled his eyes in despair.
"Where is a mango to be found in England in April, I ask you?"
"So how do you satisfy the lady's appetites?" I asked demurely. He grinned at the double entendre.
"You converse like a Frenchwoman. I cannot give her the mango. Such a thing does not exist here in this season. So one day,
In despair, I created one from marzipan. I took the almond paste and sculpted and painted and tinted until it was exquisite, impossible to tell from the real thing. I sent it up to her, and she sent it back, and asked it be given to the poor for their pleasure. But she dispatched her grandson to bring me her compliments.
Her grandson? I asked, widening my eyes.
A nice enough boy. A man, I should say. Perhaps 20 or a little more. He is shy, but the sort of shyness which means he sees much. His grandmother is a strong personality, you understand. He has not many opportunities to put himself forwards. But it is easy to see that he adores her, and she him. He is learning her ways.
What sort of ways?
Stoker inquired.
The way of the leader, Julien replied succinctly. The Maharani is a most alluring woman, but she is not languid. She does not lie about and order her servants to attend her and think of nothing but her clothes. She entertains often, many men of politics and business. For her, India should be free. She speaks openly of such things. It was the mission of her husband, you understand, but he was killed many, many years ago.
Was it, perchance, 30 years ago?
Stoker asked.
Something like that, Julien said. I do not know the details, only that she has been a widow for a very long time, and she carries on his work, speaking out for the independence of India.
Like Lakshmi Bai,
Stoker said. Julien tipped his head.
Who is this?
Lakshmi Bai was the Rani of Jhansi, a place in northern India. During the rebellion in 1857, she led her own troops into battle. She fought and died for the independence of her people. Britons think of her as a dangerous rebel, but to Indians who want to be free of our empire, she is quite the heroine. They say she is buried under a tamarind tree, and that her spirit inspires those who would cast off their oppressors.
A most interesting woman,
Julien observed.
Indeed, and any woman who follows in her footsteps is bound to make a stir,
Stoker said. All the travel to whip up support, the quiet efforts to arm those who embrace resistance, I imagine it must all be terribly expensive, I mused. Stoker nodded.
Certainly. Anyone truly committed to the cause cannot spend their days farming or breeding livestock or doing any other work to make money. They must be supported. And, as you say, weapons are costly.
The Maharani is staying at an expensive hotel, I went on. I am curious about the state of her finances. Many of the Indian princes are fabulously wealthy. I was thinking particularly of the Nizam of Hyderabad and his extravagant lifestyle. It was said an entire wing of his palace was devoted to his clothes, for he never wore the same ensemble twice. Other princes, however, lived in much quieter style, scarcely more affluent than the average English squire. I wondered where the Maharani of Viratanagar fit into this picture. Julien brightened.
But I can tell you that,
he said with some pride.
Her clothes and jewels are extraordinary, but she does not have many. She dresses like the queen she is, yet I have seen her already in the same ensemble, though she has been here only 1 week. She eats simply, rice and vegetables, and her jewels are those handed down through the family. When one of the Rajas from Uttar Pradesh comes, he takes the whole of the upper two floors, every suite for his family and his court officials. They order everything on the menu, and his wife and daughters spend every day shopping. The parcels that are delivered, they come every minute of every hour. Dresses, boots, ribbons, furniture. Not the Maharani. She does not shop. When she entertains, it is over tea, made with spices over a brazier in her own rooms. She has serious conversations with serious men.
She might be short of money, I ventured. Stoker shrugged.
Oh, she is simply frugal and bent upon her purpose in coming here.
Whatever that may be, I finished. I rose and pulled on my gloves. Thank you for your time, Julien. It has been pleasurably instructive, as ever. He kissed me again on both cheeks and pressed a wrapped packet of marzipan mice into Stoker's hands for the journey home. Our business finished earlier than we expected. We left a note for Harry with a porter, informing him that we were returning to the Belvedere and telling him to meet us there. I believed what I had told Stoker regarding the unlikelihood of Harry discovering the Eye of the Dawn in our absence, but I saw no point in tempting fate. The sooner we were back in the Belvedere, the sooner we removed any temptation from Harry. We gave the note to the porter and emerged onto the street. Stoker fished the packet of marzipan mice out of his pocket and tore into it with gusto. Really? You cannot wait until we are in the cab, I began, lifting my arm. Before he could respond, the driver of a vehicle waiting at the curb lifted his whip to acknowledge me. I opened the door just as I noticed the unusual height of the driver, possibly 6.5 feet, I would have guessed, with bright blonde hair under a greasy cap that had been jammed low on his head. I paused, 1 foot on the step, my hand on the open door, as I stared into the dimness of a compartment whose windows had been entirely covered with heavy black oilcloth.
"Miss Speedwell," said a low voice. "Get in."
I had not seen the figure, shrouded in black and tucked into the shadows of the far corner of the conveyance, but I could just make out the glint of a small revolver aimed at my head. The hand tightened around the gun as I hesitated.
"If you do not, I will shoot your companion, and I dare say I will not miss at this distance."
The voice went on. I heaved myself into the carriage, taking the seat opposite.
"What the devil?"
Stoker began. He broke off mid-sentence as soon as he caught sight of the revolver. "Yes," I said with a sigh of annoyance, "we are being abducted. Again."